Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
200 evacuees from New Orleans are settling into military Camp Edwards on Cape Cod here in Massachusetts. Meanwhile, Gulf Coast meteorologists are keeping an eye on Tropical Storm Ophelia, which they say is moving away from the U.S. for now. The National Hurricane Center says Ophelia has the potential to become a hurricane later today or tomorrow. And there are new questions today about Michael Brown, head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Immediately after Katrina hit, President Bush praised his friend Brownie for his work. But since then, fingers have pointed at the agency and particularly at Brown, whose resume included a stint as head of the International Arabian Horse Association, a far cry from coordinating disaster relief efforts. Reporters at Time magazine have been looking at Brown's online biography. Jeremy Kaplan is a staff writer for Time. And Jeremy, let's just tick through some of what you say you've discovered, starting with Michael Brown's claim that he was assistant city manager in Edmond, Oklahoma.
That's right. On both the White House bio and the FEMA bio for Brown, he's described as having overseen the emergency services division. He, in fact, was essentially in an intern-like position. He was an administrative assistant to Mr. Bill Dashner at the time, the city manager. According to his bio, he held the position between 75 and 78, but we found that, in fact, he was there between 77 and 80.
Well, and if you look at those numbers and at Michael Brown, he would have had to have been a very young man at that time.
That's right. In fact, he didn't actually earn his college degree until 1978. And his law degree until 1981. So he was actually hired as a student.
And you spoke to the former city manager, Bill Dashner, for whom Michael Brown was, as he said, an administrative assistant. What did he say of him?
Well, he spoke nicely of Mr. Brown. He described him as having worn nice clothes and so on, but one might say that he's been damned with faint praise. He in fact, wasn't responsible for emergency services, And his position, again, was largely administrative.
But now, as you write, the Deputy Strategic Director in FEMA's Office of Public Affairs has responded to your article saying that while Brown began as an intern, he became an assistant city manager with a distinguished record of service. Do you find a record of that?
Well, he in fact, was assistant to the city manager. But again, he was not responsible for emergency services in any way. And the people we spoke with who actually worked with him at the time, again, reiterated that fact, that he wasn't responsible for emergency services, that that wasn't part of his job. And it's unfortunate that much of the discussion about his being prepared for the position centered around his experience in that post.
You also looked at Michael Brown's biography on findlaw.com, a website provided by lawyers. He is a lawyer. It is saying that he taught at Central State University and was awarded an honor for teaching. What did you find?
Well, we found that that wasn't, in fact, the case, that he hadn't been a professor there. We also found that there was some other information posted there that was inaccurate. He described himself as a director of the Oklahoma Christian Home, a nursing home in Edmond, Oklahoma. But, in fact, people there weren't familiar with him at all. They had never heard of him having any association with that nursing home. They said he had never been a director or never been on the board of directors. So it appears that that was something that seems to have been fabricated as well.
We should note also, much has been made of his one qualification, that he was the head of the International Arabian Horse Association. That was once listed on his biographies. Is it still?
No, and it's interesting. As of yesterday, that was removed from his Find Law bio, and in fact, there's been some reporting around that issue, and it seems as if he was asked to leave or agreed to leave under some difficult circumstances. It seems a lot of people in that organization were very unhappy with his performance. So even in that post, he didn't quite perform satisfactorily, it seems.
Jeremy Kaplan, a staff writer for Time magazine, which has been exploring the online biographies of Michael Brown, the head of FEMA. What do you think that this will mean?
Well, it's clearly going to raise some new questions about Brown's qualifications. He's already been challenged for his response to the disaster. But now people are looking back a little further and questioning whether he was even qualified in the first place to take this post. We're focusing on Brown's credentials, but you know, the more we look into the secondary officials' credentials, we find very similar things. Not falsifications, but just, you know, complete lack of any relevant experience. His second in command, Patrick Rode, you know, was basically an advanced staffer, you know, scouting locations for the campaign. You know, similarly, the number three guy, a lot of these guys had no emergency experience.
Jeremy Kaplan of Time Magazine. Jeremy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, 2 weeks after Hurricane Katrina, many people are asking the question, why is it that so many private companies and businesses were prepared for the storm and its aftermath when government so clearly was not? Walmart knew that items that would be most in demand after the hurricane and sent those goods to the Gulf region before the storm. Apparently, strawberry pop-tops were on the list. But Walmart trucks filled with water were turned away by FEMA officials after the storm. Joining us in the studio is Dr. Yossi Sheffi. He's professor of engineering systems at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he heads the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics. And he's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Resilient Enterprise. And Professor, you write about resiliency in business. What do you mean?
Resilience is actually a physical property of material, of being able to bounce back from some deformation. Businesses can be thought of in exactly the same term, organizations in general, in terms of being able to quickly bounce back, to get back to the original level of sales, services to the citizens in the case of the government.
Well, this is just take one small example that you give that speaks a lot. Is it as simple as having, let's say, more than one supplier of your goods?
Yes and no. In my book, I talk about several ways of becoming more resilient. One is to have redundancy. Redundancy can have several aspects. One can have more inventory of parts and finished goods. One may have more than one supplier. One may have parts that are interchangeable that can be put in many products. So it has several aspects, and it's actually not as simple as having more than one supplier because there are costs for having one supplier. An example that I give in my book is that the Land Rover had a single supplier for all its chassis for its Discovery vehicle, and unbeknownst to them, that supplier one day went out of business and they didn't want to supply any more of the chassis unless Land Rover would pay all the debt. Land Rover learned a very important lesson that if you have a single supplier, you have to watch them. Now, watching them is an expensive business and you have to invest in it. You don't have to do it, but if you don't do it, then you have to have multiple suppliers.
Well, let's look at New Orleans.
Please.
This is a city, we've spoken of the problems the city had. It's well known, you know, below sea level. It was well known, as we've said on the program, that the levees were weak. Putting that aside, what can New Orleans do now? If there is a new New Orleans, how can that city be more resilient?
Okay. First, being resilient is not an event. It's a process. So New Orleans had to become more resilient by being more prepared. The interesting thing to me is how many businesses understood and heeded the warning and got ready, whether it was Home Depot that set emergency centers well before, 3 or 4 days before the hurricane struck, whether it's Walmart that started moving supplies into certain stores in the area. Mm. But let me raise another point that we found in our research that have direct bearing on what happened in New Orleans. We found that one of the main differences between resilient companies, companies that make it after disruption, and companies that suffer badly and even go out of business, is something that we could not explain in the structure of the operation in their supply chain. It's some corporate culture that has certain characteristics that make them resilient. One of the most striking examples is resilient companies push decision level very low in the organization.
Yeah.
For example, in Toyota, any worker on the production line, if they see anything that can cause a quality problem to a car, has the responsibility and the authority to stop the production line. A team will come in and solve the problem and not delay solving the problem. On a U.S. Navy carrier, every sailor on the deck has the authority and the responsibility. We are talking about somebody who could be 19 years old, during flight operation, if they see something dangerous, something that they don't like out of the ordinary, they have the responsibility and the authority to stop flight operations immediately. Because people in a resilient organization understand that when disruption is imminent, there is no time to go to the bureaucratic processes.
Boy, and this is, I'm hearing
it
you speak.
It is so apropos to what happened. So this is just one example. The other example in resilient organization, the culture is a culture of communications. They constantly communicate on many, many levels. In Dell, for example, not only they have weekly meetings and daily meetings, every 2 hours, every one of the executives gets on their PDA, on their phone, a report of the production and what's going on. Every 2 hours, just so everybody knows. So if a disruption, everybody can act immediately with the most up-to-date information. If communication lines break down, everybody knows the latest status of what was going on.
But that's not how American governments work. That's not how agencies work. You know that.
Yes.
And I'm hearing your frustration that's... Can governments work that way?
Of course government can work this way. Let me give you one last thing that also... One of the most famous cases of resilience was in... when a fire hit a Philips plane in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and both Nokia and Ericsson...
Both cell phone companies were getting their chips from this plant
The inside of the phone, the electronics inside of the phone. The plant had problems with its fire. It was a very small fire, but they thought it would take a week. It took months. Meanwhile, Nokia acted immediately. They, first of all, Philips called both of them, said, look, this is just going to take 1 week. Nokia immediately on a watch list. They started calling them every 2 hours, starting just tell us what's going on. Ericsson is a much more fun company to work with because they're much more relaxed. And Ericsson, nobody notified anybody. The guys who took the phone call just said, hey, it's another problem in supply chain. They happen all the time. 4 weeks later, when the chips stop coming, they say, whoa, something is happening here. They start calling Philips, calling other suppliers. Nokia already had all the worldwide supply of chips. Now, the main difference between them is in the company culture, in the urgency to act. In this, some people have studied this, call it mindfulness. That's another thing that was not exhibited, let's say, very strongly by some government agency. Mm-hmm. They're real caring about their own mission.
You talk about building redundancy into businesses so that you, again, don't have just one supplier. Doesn't that run counter to the thinking at many companies?
That's a very good question. I am not advocating redundancy. In fact, what I'm advocating is flexibility. And Dell, for example, builds computer to order. What happens if somebody comes up with a new chip? It's not a problem for Dell. Dell, within a few days, will stop building something with the wrong component. So this is an example of flexibility.
That's Dr. Yossi Sheffi, an engineering systems professor at MIT and the author of the forthcoming book, The Resilient Enterprise. Well, when we come back, how governments can translate that flexibility into action. There's much more coming up here and now. On how government and business can bounce back from disaster. Our guest, Dr. Yossi Sheffi, he's an engineering systems professor at MIT and the author of the forthcoming book, The Resilient Enterprise. And Dr. Sheffi, you were just talking about how giving more workers more authority to make emergency decisions and having the ability to change decisions quickly are two hallmarks of resilient organizations. So how would you change government to be a better working system? I see you're smiling.
Yes, I'm smiling because anybody who's a system thinker has to be so frustrated, even angry at what happened. It's I would start by changing the culture, and the culture is the culture of blame. If you have a culture of blame, which is, you know, seems to be part of our society, there'll be congressional inquiries and What people worry about is covering their behind and not rather than taking decisive action at the cost of maybe they will be wrong. We have to protect the people who make mistakes. That's the being able at the local level. How come the mayor of New Orleans, and I don't know what their laws are, but the mayor of New Orleans who ordered an evacuation could not, for example, call fellow mayors in or governors in adjacent states and say, why don't you start getting your National Guard ready? Because something maybe happened. And at worst, run a weekend exercise and then send them home if nothing happens. That's what I mean, driving the decision down. The decision has to go all the way up to FEMA and the president, and it takes time. Let me give you an example from totally another area. I've traveled a lot in Europe. I spent a year in England, and people always ask me, what's the difference? Why there are so many businesses that start in the United States? And my answer is because it's not a stigma to fail here as an entrepreneur. That is part of the culture that needs to be instilled in government operations as well.
We're talking to Dr. Yossi Sheffy. His upcoming book is called The Resilient Enterprise. You describe in it a nightmare scenario, and it's not what many would think. It's not a nuclear bomb. What is it?
The nightmare scenario is an attack where people don't know they're under attack. For example, think about the biological agent that's being put in the air, in the water, in the food supply, and it takes several weeks in order to people to realize that they are sick, and meanwhile, they are infecting each other. So the most important thing is develop methods of detection, of early detection. And the Center for Disease Control is, of course, thinking about it and have lots of methods, and they take sampling every morning of hospital admissions to see if there's certain concentrations of certain things. And we are coming back to Katrina. When you see seasoned forecasters on TV in the National Hurricane Center telling you they have never seen something that bad, somebody should take notice. And the mayor of New Orleans did take notice. But in general, I would say it is very difficult for organization to know something. When did, for example, in 9/11, when did the government know that we are under attack? The best that can be said is that over some time, certain parts of the government knew certain things, and until enough of the government knew enough things, the order came to launch some fighters that were going against the airplane that finally crashed in Pennsylvania. But for organization to realize something, it's not instantaneous. This is exactly coming back to the people who will realize that something is happening and can do something about it is so-called the front line, the people who are facing it. It's, in this case, the mayor of New Orleans. It's in Toyota is a production line, and in Dell is the people on the production line. Aircraft carrier, the people on the deck. These are the people who A, realize that something is developing, and B, can do something about it.
Yossi Sheffy, one last question. You also speak a lot about communications, and it seems as if from 9/11 to the shuttle disasters to Katrina, we have the most high technology in the world, and we cannot communicate.
Yes, during 9/11, famously, the police and fire department were on different frequencies.
So what do you recommend? How do you become resilient when it comes to communications?
The issue there are entirely have nothing to do with technology. They entirely have to do with reporting lines, organization lines, agreeing to work together. The technology is there. In the days of the internet and PDAs and pager, it is simply a decision to do it. And Intel, for example, has in every country they do business with an emergency center that has people and processes who are trained at what to do, but not only this. These people have every communication device known to man, from regular phone to cell phone to single sign bed radio to ham radio, so they can communicate with their headquarters and tell them what is going on.
After 9/11, everyone thought that'll never happen again. We'll be more in touch. You're shaking your head. Now we have Katrina. Do you think now some of these system failures might change?
Yes. I actually think that maybe it's wishful thinking, but I actually think that Katrina can have a positive impact on several grounds. First of all, the importance of emergency management and planning for the unexpected, I think, was just highlighted. On a national level, I hope that this will lead to more realistic use of energy supplies. But let me give you another thing that I think will happen. After Enron and Tyco and all the other guys that were involved in all these scandals, there was a view of the private sector. You know, CEOs were not held in high regard. Private companies were not held in high regard. I think that understanding what private companies did will change how the private sector is seen by many people in the United States as caring, capable, and doing something.
Prepared,
yeah. Absolutely.
Dr. Yossi Sheffi, professor of engineering systems at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He heads the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics. He's also author of the forthcoming book, The Resilient Enterprise. Dr. Sheffi, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin, for having me.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
Thousands of animals trapped in waterlogged New Orleans, according to the Humane Society, and there is now a race against time. In addition to wanting to save the animals for humanitarian reasons, health officials fear the stranded pets will pose a massive health problem by spreading disease after a large die-off. There's also a fear that starving dogs may form packs and attack rescue workers. Several agencies are rescuing animals and bringing them to huge makeshift shelters in Texas and New Orleans, and owners are searching for pets on internet bulletin boards, where other pet lovers are also offering foster homes. Shirley Minshew is with the International Fund for Animal Welfare, based on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. They've dispatched a team to the Gulf, and Shirley is speaking to us from the flooded streets of New Orleans. Shirley, I know you've had lots of experience seeing animals in misery, trying to get them out of it. How does this situation in New Orleans compare?
It's such a big disaster. It's kind of like a Hurricane Andrew, but with water, and much bigger. Mm. And the animals, the water is so contaminated, and the water, you know, the animals get into it. They get thirsty enough, they try to drink it. And it's just full, it's so polluted. Yeah, the animals, if they're not rescued quickly, they end up very ill. We got one today that was just, he'd been laying almost in the water, mostly in the water and part out, for 4 days. And, you know, we triaged it and stabilized it and got it transported right out to the center.
Was it a dog or?
A dog, sorry.
No, that's okay. And we understand that just moments ago you were putting an IV in a cat. You know, there are people who, you know, for some of us who are animal lovers, saving animals in and of itself is important, but it's become even more so in New Orleans because there are people who won't leave without their pets. Are you coming across those people?
Yeah, we rescued a pig it was a pot-bellied pig they'd had for 10 years since it was a little piglet, and this was like a child to them. They just loved this animal. It lived in the house, was housebroken, and they would not leave until the pig was rescued out of there, and they were just ecstatic. I mean, just listen to how happy the family was.
Well, in fact, we can listen. We have a little bit of the owner that you recorded. Let's listen.
You called, and it was like, yes, what has happened? So we're very happy. I thought we could deal with everything else, can deal with losing the house, but I couldn't deal with leaving the pig behind and thinking about the kind of deaths you're going. And we were all trying to figure out who we could get to shoot her. But then it was like, what are you going to do with the carcass? What are you going to do with a 300-pound pig? You can't keep her, and you can't let her die in the closet. So this is, you know, you guys are angels. I mean, we're happy now. We're happy. This has been a concern. We could deal with everything else. We can deal with the water. We can deal with the loss, you know, the rebuilding the city. But this is my little girl.
That's James Parsons, and a lot of animal lovers will understand his emotion. And Shirley, we understand that you also rescued a woman who wouldn't leave without her cats. What else are you seeing?
We picked up iguanas. Birds have been rescued. People that had evacuated from the Superdome to the Astrodome that smuggled their animals on the bus with them, and then they needed a place to keep the animals, which they went to the Houston SPCA. And will be kept there until the owners can reclaim them.
Well, in fact, we were all disturbed by the story of a little boy when they were evacuating from the Superdome. They forcibly pulled his little dog Snowball out of his hands, and the little boy started vomiting. Was that an emotional moment? He had to leave his dog behind.
Right. It's like leaving his little, sibling behind. They're very attached, and children especially, they can't take their toys with them. They can't take, anything that they love and are used to in a normal life. But that dog is part of their normal life. And to be able to have that normalcy is just so important for children as well as it is for the adults.
Well, we understand that you are armed with a list of 3,000 names from your website?
Yes.
How did that work? People go to the website and what, tell you where their animals are?
Right. We take the list and we go to the houses. We get into the house, we find the animals, and then we're able to bring them out. Unfortunately, some of the houses are underwater, and there's no chance that the animal in there is even alive anymore. Yeah, and it's discouraging, but, the next rescue helps get over that a little bit.
We're talking to Shirley Minshew of the International Fund for Animals, who's right there at the waters, in the water in New Orleans. She and crew have been rescuing animals. And we understand also people that at one point a helicopter indicated where some elderly people were.
Yes, the National Guard helicopter kept leading us into this area. And when we got there, we thought maybe it was a dog they had found. And there was a family on the porch. I'm sorry, I got another helicopter going over.
That's quite all right.
And they said their father had had a stroke 2 days ago and could no longer walk. So we ended up rearranging crates and animals and people and putting all four. The gentleman was in his 70s and his wife and the two sons, and took them back in. We had an ambulance waiting for the man when we got back to the staging area, and they were all taken care of from there.
Well, Shirley, you also become our reporter there in the waters of New Orleans. How bad is it? I mean, what's your sense of the water and the damage?
It's just terrible. The water, like I said, the water is so polluted and so contaminated, and the houses are just full of it. I just don't see any way these people are going to get back into their homes and live a normal life again. It's just, the water is just almost black from the oil and everything that's in it.
Have you been to the shelters?
Yes. We actually, when we first came in, we worked with the Houston SPCA, who is taking all of these animals in and housing them. They took in 500 animals that were smuggled in on the buses to the Astrodome, from the Superdome to the Astrodome, and they're housing those there, waiting for the people to come back and claim them. And while we were there, there were a few that were claimed, and they just... Yeah, it was so joyful to see that happen. Mm. It's just wonderful to see how many animals are being saved and are being able to be cared for.
For those people, Shirley, who may be questioning, why all this effort to save animals? I mean, I mentioned you're saving people as well, especially people who wouldn't leave without their animals. But how do you answer that question?
Well, understandably, people are in the need first. They should be priority. It's human life. But at the same time, we need to rescue those animals, not just for the animals' sake, but for the pet owners' sake. It's like, that's all they have. Their homes are destroyed. They'll probably never be able to go back and live in those homes. And all they want is their pet out. They just want something that's normal.
That's Shirley Minshew with the International Fund for Animal Welfare, standing in the flooded streets of New Orleans. By the way, Shirley says the best way for people to help the effort is with financial donations. For links to the many animal welfare sites, please visit our website, here-now.org. And by the way, nearly all of the animals in the zoo in New Orleans survived the storm, but nearly all of the 10,000 fish in the city's aquarium died in the flooding. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Time now to open the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts, and most of them this week regard Hurricane Katrina. In the first days after the storm hit, we spoke with several current and former emergency officials who criticized the federal government for, among other things, cutting funds for levee repair in the New Orleans area last year. And they said the federal government should have known the city was cash-strapped. But Joseph Gallucci of Phoenix, Arizona, saw it another way. He pointed out that city officials made a DVD that was distributed to New Orleans residents in late July, in effect saying they were on their own in an emergency, that the city didn't have the resources to move people out of harm's way. And Joseph writes, so let's investigate what went right and what went wrong, but let's start in City Hall in New Orleans. Well, one of our guests, Dr. Neil Livingston of Global Options, agreed. But his suggestions brought many angry emails, including this one from Diane Pervin of Medford, Massachusetts. She says, yes, both local and state governments are notorious for corruption in Louisiana. But to suggest that the state and the city, among the poorest in the country, should have taxed their own citizens to pay for reinforcing the levees is unconscionable. And to suggest that Louisiana and Mississippi should have generated a stronger and more rapid National Guard response, while at least a third of the regiments are in Iraq, is disingenuous. Structural protection of major industrial centers is clearly a federal responsibility. The Bush administration should be held accountable for the death and devastation wrought by its policies. Well, we also spoke with author Richard Ford and later with Dr. Michael Lomax of the United Negro College Fund about whether race played a role in storm recovery, with poverty an accepted part of the New Orleans tapestry. Julia Zanes of Saxton River, Vermont, wrote, I think some people do think the patina of poverty is part of what gives New Orleans its charm, and the lack of social services part of what gives the city its Wild West atmosphere. Some things which seem incredible to an outsider were accepted simply because they were traditional. And as I watch the news and see young African Americans being arrested for trying to escape in a mail truck, I can't help but wonder if they would be hailed as heroes were they white. Gary Keyes from Kannapolis, North Carolina, writes, my suggestion, from a white redneck from North Carolina, report the positive, too. Report the people from Duke Power and Pike Electric going to help and doing some very dangerous work. Well, duly noted, Gary. And Richard Saunders of the University of Tennessee, who streams Here and Now over the Internet on KBMC out of Billings, Montana, wrote after he heard our piece about college students displaced by the storm. He says, that piece really grabbed me. This morning, Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen offered the state's higher education institutions to New Orleans students who need to stay in school. We are already fielding queries. And Tom Lorenzen of Lake Norman, North Carolina, sent a correction after a couple of guests said the Calvary was coming to the Gulf. Calvary is defined as the hill where Jesus was crucified, or a sculpture of the crucifixion, or a great ordeal. And Tom writes, Calvary is not coming to New Orleans. It's already there for those poor unfortunates. Perhaps you meant the cavalry is coming. Yes, we did. And Christy Somerville from Iowa City, Iowa, asked about the Randy Newman song we played this week. She writes, you said it was written about the Louisiana flood of a long time ago. What was it? Well, Christy, it was called Louisiana 1927. We wanted to hear it again as well.
River rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all night. River has busted through, clear down to Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana, Louisiana, they're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. You can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
What the river has done to this poor cracker's land. Louisiana.
anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the United States. The date will be marked in New York with a memorial service and moments of silence. In Washington, the Pentagon is planning a 9/11 concert and a freedom walk, which is drawing criticism because of planned cross-references to the war in Iraq. Well, Hollywood is also turning its lens on 9/11. Paramount Pictures is planning a film directed by Oliver Stone, the man behind Platoon, JFK, and Wall Street. It will star Nicolas Cage and Michael Peña as Port Authority officers trapped under the wreckage of the Twin Towers. And Universal Pictures says its film will center around Flight 93, the plane that crashed in a Pennsylvania field after a valiant takeover by passengers. It will be helmed by British director Paul Greengrass, probably best known for The Bourne Supremacy. So how might these two very different directors approach a subject that still arouses such passion? Joining us in the studio are Boston Globe and Here Now pop culture critic Renee Graham. Welcome as usual, Renee.
Hi, Robin.
And Dave Wildman, arts editor and film critic for Boston's Weekly Dig. Dave, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And I want to start with you, Renee. Oliver Stone. Some people think his films are a little overwrought. I happen to think that one scene in one of his films, while potentially overwrought, is just one of the best. It's in his Academy Award-winning film Platoon, one of the most iconic scenes from that movie. It's the death of Willem Dafoe's character, Elias, in Vietnam. He's shot by the Viet Cong after being left behind by his own helicopter mates. Let's listen. Renee Graham, you wonder, where can a director go after you've already used Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, underscoring this incredible scene with Willem Dafoe raising his arms up, begging, to the departing helicopter?
Platoon really is a passion play, and that's the centerpiece of the passion play. It's a crucifixion scene. His arms are open, his head is back. He's dying, you know, in the jungles of Vietnam. It's a really powerful scene. I mean, I could see where it would provoke strong passions, people feel it goes too far, but you are talking about a war and a very divisive war at that. I think so, it should be a provocative scene, and it's the moment that everyone, I think, really remembers from the film.
But once you've done, Dave, the crucifixion scene with, again, Adagio for Strings, where do you go from there to depict 9/11? Do you go quieter, smaller?
I doubt if he's going to go quieter, smaller.
He's been controversial before. Do you think controversy awaits us now?
I don't believe so. Not in this film, at least what I've heard about it. It's based on the personal story of two Port Authority officers that were trapped underneath the building.
I think an advantage that Oliver Stone has in doing the film this way is he's using two real characters, two people who survived. So it doesn't really allow him to veer off from what actually happened. They were there. They know what happened. I think he's going to surprise people.
How about the people who expect him to make it political?
You know, I don't know. It's difficult to say. I mean, I think at this point, September 11th has been so politicized, it almost seems like any approach to the film is going to have some political viewpoint. But I don't think that's what Oliver Stone is trying to do. I don't think he's going to make statements about the Bush administration or America's foreign policy. I think he's attempting to tell the story of what happened on that tragic day through these two men.
My guess is that Oliver Stone is going to stay away from the polemics and stay away from the political statement in this. And he's going to wait until the Bush administration is out of office, and then he's going to do his Nixon about Bush and get it all off his chest.
Oh, okay. That's down the road. Well, Dave Wildman, director Paul Greengrass, has said of his upcoming film that he wants to take a documentary approach. It's going to be partly improvised with handheld cameras. Does this sounding familiar to you?
Yeah, like Bloody Sunday.
Right. And for people who haven't seen that film, Bloody Sunday tells the story of the 1972 shooting of 14 Irish protesters by British soldiers during a civil rights demonstration in Northern Ireland. Let's listen to a clip from that film where an Irish member of Parliament excoriates the British government at a hastily convened press conference after the incident.
You have destroyed the civil rights movement. And you've given the IRA the biggest victory it will ever have. All over this city tonight, young men, boys, will be joining the IRA, and you will reap a whirlwind.
Dave Wildman, when I ask you, as we listen to Bloody Sunday, you know, with this sort of documentary feel, it's going to be interesting, don't you think? Because a director's going to have a lot of competition if they make a documentary like film about 9/11 because there is so much footage of 9/11.
This is true, but this story is actually going to be about the part of the story that's not known, what happened on Flight 93. It's complete speculation.
Yes, all we know are those horrendously painful cell phone calls.
Right. This film kind of scares me in a sense. To make a film that looks like a documentary gives the film an incredible amount of authority over how the event is rendered. And the director is in a position to editorialize without people being quite aware just how much they're editorializing. Mm-hmm. In Bloody Sunday, there's a scene with one of the main characters, this kid who got involved with his friends and started throwing things at the British police. He ends up getting shot by the British, but he's still alive. They're driving him to the hospital, and there's a roadblock. British pull him out, throw everybody against the wall except this kid because he's dying in the back of the car. The next scene you see, the kid is dead, and they're putting bombs in his pockets.
To frame him
as a bomber. And I don't think that Paul Greengrass could really have known that that really happened. So to me, that's pure editorializing.
Not just editorializing, but creating the image that will replace the void in people's minds. I mean, people, as we do, right, Renee, when we watch movies, we'll say, well, that's how it happened.
Well, I think in a way the void has so much been filled, especially with Flight 93. We have this sense of what happened. The people attacked the hijackers. They, purposely crashed a plane. They saved it from hitting the Capitol or the White House. But what if Greengrass decides he doesn't want to tell that story? What if he doesn't want to make the passengers that heroic? How will people react to him somehow contradicting what they think they already know about Flight 93? The bottom line is that nobody knows what happened on Flight 93. No one survived to tell what happened on Flight 93.
Do you think other film directors are saying, darn, why didn't I get my project in sooner or better than me?
I think they felt they had to take a respectful period of time to deal with that. I'm not sure they're going to have as much restraint with Hurricane Katrina, frankly. But I think that there was a sense that people aren't going to be ready for this. We have to give them time and sort of see.
The temptation in Hollywood is to exaggerate. This is an event, again, as Renee was saying, that everybody has seen. And the impact that it had is something that you can't soft pedal. I think they're going to be tempted to try to recreate that impact. What I don't want to see is I don't want to see the towers coming down with incredibly powerful classical music in the background or,
special effects.
You've
felt it through. You don't want to see those buildings come down on screen.
No, I don't.
I don't think everyone has seen the actual images. A lot of people watch the images live. I don't think people want to see some CGI plane crashing into a CGI World Trade Tower.
CGI?
Computer-generated, graphics. I just don't think anybody really wants to see that. It would just seem silly. And I think if Hollywood's going to do that, they're going to somehow, as David said, make it even more dramatic. But I'm not sure you can make it more dramatic than it was.
Boston Globe pop culture critic Renee Graham and Dave Wildman, arts editor for Boston's Weekly Dig, speaking to us about approaching 9/11 in film, and Hollywood is doing that. Two projects on the docket. Renee and Dave, thanks very much.
Thanks, Robin.
Thanks.
Autumn on the rain will fall, like tears from a star, like tears from a star.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again, Here and Now.
How fragile we are. How fragile we are. How fragile we are.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, join us next time for the news and